Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is Judy Bellow on China. Judy Bellow has been an anti-war activist since she started protesting the Vietnam War in 1969. Today, Judy is editor and administrator of a number of anti-war websites, including the United National Anti-War Coalition, No to War, Ban Killer Drones, and Sanctions Kill. She loves to visit countries in the Global South that are pivotal to world peace and development, and has visited Syria, Lebanon, and Iran several times. She spent a month in China in the summer of 2025, which is the subject of this interview. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. So, Judy, when did you go to China? How did the trip come about?
I went to China last August and September.
August and September of 2025, right?
Yes, that's right. And I left around the 16th of August, and I came back on the 21st of September. That may sound like a long time, but I had a visa, so I can spend a month there if I want. And I decided to just do a lot of things while I was there and not waste the plane fare, so to speak. So I kind of did three different trips while I was there. First, I rested in Shanghai a little bit, and then I went to the province of Guizhou, where they have the latest great success in their poverty alleviation programs. And in Guizhou, there were a handful of us from DSA who joined a group of people whose ancestors, mostly grandparents, parents and grandparents, though, had spent the 30s in China assisting the people against the Japanese occupation. This was a terrible time for China, and this particular province was so desperately poor. But one of the things that was happening is that the Red Army was staying there part of the time because it was remote, and so they were less likely to be attacked. And the Japanese were doing so much harm. So most of these people that were there were doctors and nurses who were basically trying to maintain a health system and to take care of the many people who were injured by the Japanese. Then the second trip, we came back and we spent time again in Shanghai and Beijing.
And while we were there,
they had the march and the celebration for the 60th anniversary of the Communist Party and of the revolution. So we were there for that. And they had a massive parade in Beijing, and they had a beautiful, some kind of a dramatic presentation. I don't know what to call it, because it was like a mixture of opera and ballet. And it was shown on TV over and over again for a couple of days so that everyone in China would have a chance to see it. And it was quite beautiful. The parade was interesting. I did watch it on TV because although I was there, I had COVID. It was pretty impressive. They had Xi riding around in some kind of small car, in an open car, standing up through the sunroof. Xi is the president and also the premier of the Communist Party. So he is the primary ruler in China at the moment. His history with the Chinese Revolution goes all the way back to when he was a small child. You know, he's in his 70s now. And his parents were participants, and they had a lot of input. So
participants in the revolution?
In the revolution. And the thing about Xi is he's very stalwart and very stable. And right now, with everything that's happening around China, that's really important. And my third trip while I was in China was that I spent 10 days in Xinjiang. And Xinjiang is the province where there's a lot of propaganda in the U.S., and there are a lot of accusations that the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese government has been mistreating the Uyghurs, who are the primary group that live in Xinjiang. Xinjiang's full name is the Uyghur Autonomous Xinjiang Province.
they are autonomous.
So it was very interesting to see what it's like there and that the propaganda is untrue. But we'll get back to that now. It's also another place where there's a lot of poverty alleviation work going on because it's way in the northwest of China, north of Tibet. So I'll start, though, with Guizhou. In Guizhou, they had a lot of poor people because it's a mountainous region, and people were living in villages in the mountains, and they were from this Miao population, a native population that's been in China forever, and they have their own cultural things going on there. To work on poverty alleviation there, there's a couple of prongs. One is to build infrastructure. So when I was there, they have the most incredible infrastructure there. They have roads going through the mountains that you just can't believe, highways that go through a mountain and then come out on the other side and go on. And they have overpasses where one road is like maybe 20 feet above the other one. It's very amazing to see. And the highways are set on pillars so that they can get from one mountain to the next. And while I was there, as we were driving through these incredible mountains, we saw hundreds, if not thousands, of solar panels and windmills high up in the mountains where they're not interfering with people's lives. There's not a lot of wildlife there because it's kind of barren because you're really high up in the mountains. And so there are just miles and miles of solar panels and windmills. And of course, there's a lot of wind in the mountains, and also it's very clear and there's a lot of sun. So it's a perfect place to have this green energy be grounded. And I'm pretty sure they said that in Guiyang, which is the capital city of Guizhou, that the majority of their power comes from these solar panels that you see in the mountains. So that's one aspect of it, is the technology. And the other aspect is that they send workers from the Communist Party out to live in the villages. And when they go to a village, they try to decide what would be the best way to help these people. Can we help them to stay here and be prosperous? Or do we have to move them into the, you know, convince them that they'd prefer to move into the city and then give the land to someone who can actually do something with it, for instance, put up solar panels or whatever, build something there. So it's a very complicated process. And our guide, her American name is Doris Du, spent 2 years in a village. And while she was there, what she basically did is she followed the problems that the people were having. And then she helped them to resolve them. And so she would say, well, you know, if you had this, because they were farmers. So she would say, well, if you have this tool, would that make it easier? And in many cases, then they would say, well, yeah, we hadn't thought about that. And so she would have the government bring in the tool and it would improve their ability to make a living off their land. And so I'm pretty sure that the place where she was is still there and they're still farming. But there are other villages where it just was impossible. They're like doing hard scrabble farming on the side of a mountain. So they have these people who are outside of communication. Even if they could get electricity, which in some cases they couldn't communicate with the rest of the society. And so they would offer to move that, to buy their property.
The Chinese government would offer
this? The Chinese government would buy their property. So they would move them into a nice apartment building in a nearby city. And they would find jobs for the people young enough to work and provide free housing for the older people. And then they would sell that property to a corporation, whatever corporation gave them the most productive way to use the land.
The use that was going to benefit society the most.
Exactly. And that is one of the differences, of course, between what the United States does and what China does, is that in the United States, they're happy to take your property and not even sell, but give it to some corporation. But the corporation might do something like drill for oil and keep all the profits. Whereas in this case, the corporation has to show that it has something worthwhile to provide to their society. So it's not a one-way street.
This all seems a far cry from the genocide we hear about in the Western media.
Yes, it is a far cry. And in Xinjiang, you see exactly the same thing. You see, and what happens is, yes, it's true that the Han Chinese who come in from Beijing or wherever, who start these companies, initially they're making most of the money and doing most of the trade. However, they hire the local people, and then the local people become part of the process, and they're able to send their children to college, and then eventually the children will become intrinsic parts of the work, and then the boss will eventually be a local person who's educated enough to do it, because when they first bring these people into the city, there's no one educated enough to take any high-level positions. But after a generation, that changes. And then the people, once again, have control over their own resources. So it's a process, and the process can't be done instantaneously. In the meantime, nobody is like left out in the cold to starve or abandoned, but instead they might get a job. I saw a video actually of one guy who was saying, well, I really miss my farm, but you know what? I noticed that I really like to cook. So I went to cooking. The government sent me to cooking school, and now I run a restaurant. And again, he was a younger guy, you know, he was 30 years old. His parents are probably located in a nice apartment somewhere, and they're not working, and they don't have to worry about whether they're going to lose their apartment or the small income they have from the government, because that's part of the transaction that brought them into the city.
And this is all because the Chinese government is trying to alleviate poverty.
That's right, because you can't alleviate poverty without moving things around and making changes. You can't keep everything as it is and change it at the same time.
The figure that I hear tossed around is that the Chinese government has lifted 800, maybe 850 million people out of extreme poverty.
Yes, they have, which means that their society looks very different from ours. And there's a lot of people, there are a lot of people in transition in their society. And those people are economically moving up the ladder. And in terms of education, they're moving up, because in China, this goes back to the 2,500 years of empire. To get a good job, you have to have a good education. And if you're smart, you can get an education there, and you are able to test into having a good education by taking tests. Even if you're a pretty poor person and you don't have much, you can rise up in the government. That's how you join the Communist Party. First, they show you some stuff when you're a little child, and then as you get older and as you become more interested, you can take tests and have new opportunities depending on how well you do. And you can move through the ranks by showing competence and interest. And at the same time, people who do not have the competence to do high-tech jobs, there's still a lot of work to be done. And you see things in China, and I noticed this in the past in Iran that we don't have here, like people cleaning the streets, people keeping the sidewalks clean. There are recycling containers all along the road. So, of course, people have to come and empty them because they're not that big, because they're every block or two in a big city. So people do the jobs to make things nice, and all that construction is a massive jobs program. And we'll see, but China, like the United States and the rest of the world, is moving into a more and more high-tech world, and we'll see what they do with that. But for now, they've solved it by giving everybody what they can do and making sure that everybody has enough money to live comfortably in society. And so if you can open a shop. If you're an enterprising person, you can open a shop somewhere. When I was in Shanghai, the road near my hotel, which was in a fairly nice area, was lined with these little restaurants that sold really basic, ordinary food. And then if you go into the mall, the nearby mall, then the whole second floor is these real high-end restaurants that sell foreign food, you know, Italian food and American food and whatever. And so, as well as really high-end Chinese food. So you have, everybody has their place in the scheme. And if you're someone who needs to eat lunch, you can go to a place that suits you and that you can afford.
I want to ask you if you consider China to be a democratic society, and how does that play into the structure of the Communist Party?
Okay, that's a great question. I do consider it to be a democratic society, and I think that for the moment, anyway, their democracy is working a lot better than ours.
Seems that way.
Yeah, well, yeah, ours is dissipating, but it has a real grounding among the people, the way they have democracy there. It starts out like in your local community, you vote for your local representative who are taking care of business in your local community. So then for the next level, the people that you voted for in your local community will vote for people in a larger community, like, say, the county. And so they would have another group of people who convene regularly and make decisions. And then the people in your, they will come back to through the people in your local community and report back to you. And then they go up the entire food chain all the way up to the National Communist Party and to the national government, which are two different things, I might add. So they have these two tracks as well. They have the Communist Party and they have the government. And in both sides, they start out with local elections and then higher level elections and higher level. But instead of the people having to vote in an election where they don't really know what's going on and what the options are, the people in the next level below them vote in that election. And so when you get to the national level, they have their five-year plans, and China loves this. They have 5 years and 7 years and 12 bullets and whatever. They love to count things off. So they have their five-year plans, and then at the end of a five-year plan, the group meets again. It may not be all exactly the same people because there have been an election, and they are provided in advance with the results of the decisions they made the last time. And so they go in, and they decide what to do about it. And if I may, I'm going to talk a little here about the Great Green Wall, which is a ecological project they have to contain the deserts. There are two really large and desiccated deserts in China. One is the Gobi, and the other is called the Taklamakan Desert, which I may or may not be pronouncing right. But in any case, both of them are very large deserts. The Taklamakan Desert is a sandy desert, and there are a lot of issues around it because it's growing because of sandstorms and things like that. So one of their big projects over the last, I don't know, 40 years is to contain these deserts and then to eventually start taking the land back and making it useful again.
Reclaiming.
Reclaiming, thank you. They want to eventually reclaim them, but just containing them is a big job. And when they first started back in the 60s, they failed. They tried and tried. People were out there planting trees and doing all these things, and it just failed. They couldn't keep them alive. And over the last 40 years or 60 years, they've tried different ways to keep those trees alive. They've tried different kinds of trees. Of course, their science has advanced. They found out that they could use rice straw to draw off little squares, and that the rice straw would keep the ground in place. So if you put some fertilizer on it and a little tree and the rice straw, then the land wouldn't just disappear under the tree, which is what was happening, one of the things that was happening. So they worked at this for a very long time, and they had many volunteers out there, large groups of volunteers out there implementing each level. And every time it would go back to the central committee. And if it didn't go well, they would say, well, who can we call in to work on this problem now? And so they have many iterations in problem solving. Nobody expects to like farm it out to a particular corporation and have a perfect answer in a couple of years. That isn't the game plan. The game plan is to make it happen any way you can. And so they've been working on this all this time. And now the Taklamakan Desert has now been contained by the Great Green Wall. And not only that, but they've been able to put a highway through it and have trees along either side of the highway that protect it so that it's safe to drive on the highway.
So the Great Green Wall, is that the trees you were talking about?
Yes, that's a wall of trees that they've been planting for years around these deserts. If you go to YouTube and look up Great Green Wall, there are a lot of great videos about it where you can see this in action. So they're very slowly working on their project, and I wouldn't be surprised if 100 years from now, the Great Taklamakan Desert isn't a desert anymore.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Judy Bello on China. Judy Bello has been an anti-war activist since she started protesting the Vietnam War in 1969. Today, Judy is editor and administrator of a number of anti-war websites, including the United National Anti-War Coalition, No to War, Ban Killer Drones, and Sanctions Kill. She spent a month in China in the summer of 2025, which is the subject of this interview. A lot of this is covered in a book called China Changes Everything, which is an anthology written by people, the various chapters written by people who went on trips to China recently, and you were one of them. You wrote a chapter on terraforming.
Yes. And what they're doing in the desert, in the Taklamakan Desert, the process that I just described, that is what terraforming means. It's using science to rejuvenate the life on the land.
Under a capitalist society, it's all extract and take immediate profits. They don't have the timeline or the intention to nurture the environment.
And it's kind of interesting because it's like use it up and move on to the next. So they're interested in changing some faraway place so they can go there, but they never thought about recovering our own space.
Right.
And making it continuously habitable. And as we all know, I think corporations externalize their losses.
They socialize the losses and privatize the profits.
That's right.
Do you think that the Chinese government wants peace in the world?
I do. And I believe them when they say they just want to do business.
That's the impression I get. They want they want peace. They want stability because they can't do business other than any humanitarian reasons that they might have. It's simply bad for business to have war, unless you're a war contractor.
It's about your definition of prosperity. Having a high stock market is the definition of prosperity in the West, whereas in the East, the definition, you know, having a very wealthy elite is the definition of prosperity in the West. So in a sense, we're still feudal. Whereas in China, the definition of prosperity is for everyone to live well. People can't make enough money to buy a house anymore. Right now, some of us older folks living in our houses are so lucky because we bought them when we could afford them. Because right now, the price of housing is through the roof. And a lot of what's happening is that landlords are buying up the properties and people are forced to rent. And so war does not bother that kind of prosperity. It assists it. But in China, if you want everyone to live well, you can't have war. War kills people. It breaks things. And the Chinese, interestingly, just since I was talking about housing, even I was surprised because so many Chinese people live in what I would call an apartment because so many people live in the big cities. But they own their houses, their condos. And they provide public services, for instance, in Shanghai, where I have to say, I don't think heat's a big issue because it's 100 degrees every day in the summer. But they have underground boilers that make it so that every building can be heated in the winter. with radiators because the government of the city maintains the boilers under the ground. And no one has to support their own heat. So everybody has what I had when I was a kid, which is an apartment that comes with heat and you can make it as hot as you want.
Sounds luxurious.
Yes, yes. In Europe, I think they have it worse than here. But, you know, we set the thermostat down to, 68 in the winter and let it go down to 62 at night because we can't afford to pay for enough electricity to stay warm 24/7. So it's a very different vision of what life should be like. And as long as the people at the bottom, like if they're dissatisfied and their representatives don't keep the gravy train coming, then they pick somebody else. And the wave moves upward. And I like Xi Jinping. I must say, I have a very high opinion of him because he's really moved it out into the people. He is the Chinese premier. And during the Cultural Revolution, his father was put in prison. And he himself spent, I think, like 10 years working in villages. Maybe it was less than that. And then he moved up into city government after that. During the Cultural Revolution, college students were required. It's kind of like the Civilian Peace Corps we had briefly under Kennedy in this country. But it was required that they go out and stay in a village and help the people there for a couple of years at least. And so people said, oh, how horrible. They take these, you know, nice middle-class kids and they send them off to these awful little dirty villages and make them work. But that way, the people in those villages learned how to fix their tractors. The young people that went there were able to open grammar schools in local villages so that you didn't have to walk 5 miles to get to school. One of the people we met in Guizhou, our translator, when he was a child, he went to a weekly boarding school. So he would walk 5 miles with a bag of rice on his back to school, spend the week there, and then walk 5 miles home every week so that he could go to school. But during the Cultural Revolution, which was actually probably around the time this kid was in school, they sent students, college students there from the cities, and they said, help these people. And the people weren't always, you know, very grateful because they were mad because these, you know, rich kids were coming and hanging out. So they actually had to win the trust of these people. And the purpose of the Cultural Revolution, and it did have its problems, there's no doubt, because they mixed two groups of people, and one of which was really angry. They gave the power to these really angry people who had nothing. But the result in the end was that those people were absorbed into the Chinese society, and they were no longer abandoned.
I'm guessing that the people from the cities benefited in some way, too, by seeing another side of things.
Well, they did, and Xi is an example of that because he learned what poverty really was to these people. And it's been a process for the Chinese Communist Party for the entire time because when they were under attack by the Republican governments, which were very unstable and very hostile, and before that by the Qing dynasty in the early 20s, they had to move into the countryside, and they relied on the support of these peasants. And while they were there, they organized the peasants to revolt against the landlords so that they didn't have to give their whole crop over to a feudal landlord. And they helped the people become literate because they were 99% illiterate in the countryside at that time. And so if you joined the Red Army, you had to, every day when you weren't in battle or something, you had to go to school every afternoon and learn to read and write. And then they would have philosophical discussions about what kind of society do you want? And so this was something that was really good for the young people who started the Chinese Revolution. They were testing their theories on the people. And at the same time, they brought all this wealth, not of money, but of education and health care and things like that to the poor people. But it wasn't enough to do it just once. This is like the third iteration now. where they have their poverty elimination program. The first iteration was in the 30s and 20s when the Red Army was trapped in the countryside. And then the second iteration was a cultural revolution. This is the third iteration of China trying to level its society so that everyone has equal opportunities, not only equal wealth and money, but equal opportunities, which is something this country always brags about, equal opportunities, but we really do not have equal opportunities. And you can go to the inner city in any city that I know of and ask around, and you will quickly learn that we do not have equal opportunities in this country. All you got to do is stop into a school in the ghetto. And in the 60s, they tried busing, but the violence from both sides is actually similar to what happened during the Cultural Revolution in China, but the Chinese didn't quit. But in our country, they more or less quit and didn't follow up to continue to bring resources to the poor people in the ghettos because racism was so stark, whereas in China, it's much less obvious, even though there are cultures there, native cultures, like here, the Native Americans are, you know, we killed most of them off, our country did. But in China, if you go to Xinjiang, the Uyghurs are still there. If you go to Guizhou, the Miao people are still there, and they still have their own cultural uniqueness.
I just want to take a little detour here. We were talking about schooling and racism and stuff.
Yes.
When I was in probably third or fourth grade, the teacher told the class that there were so many Chinese people and they were so violent and threatening that if they wanted to, they could all start walking toward the Pacific Ocean and walk on each other's heads. The people underneath would then drown. And then the rest of them would just walk all the way across the Pacific Ocean and overrun the entire United States.
That is so horrible. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Which tells us to be afraid of the Chinese, but also that the Asian people don't care about their lives.
It does tell you that, and it's horrible. But that kind of racism in the United States is kind of funny because I grew up in the city, but in kind of what you might call an Italian ghetto. And of course, it wasn't an impoverished ghetto anymore by the time I was a child. But it was hostile to foreigners. I don't think I ever met a Chinese person until I was an adult. So the racism was focused around Black people who were new to our community. And of course, they didn't want new people coming in from outside who are new to our community. And they were real obvious because they were a different color. But there's a lot of racism towards Chinese people in this country. And I know when I was in my 20s, I had a wonderful job working for a Chinese restaurant. I just met so many great people there. And they really changed my life in a way of the way that I see the people around me and the way that I understand foreign cultures. For one thing, they had one of the family's brothers that owned the restaurant was deaf. And he was forced to be the dishwasher because you can't really wait on people if you can't talk to them. And it would be hard to be a chef, too, because the head chef, when Rocky calls out, do thus and so, you wouldn't hear him. But he was an artist. And they arranged a marriage for him with a lovely woman. He had some beautiful children. We used to hang around the restaurant sometimes. They were delightful and very bright. But he wasn't sent away because he was disabled. He wasn't sent to a place for deaf people. He wasn't sent to a place for disabled people. He was kept right in the heart of the family. And he was a member of the family with equal worth to every other person in the family. And no one worried about, oh, what are we going to do with him? He just held his place in the family. And he used to occasionally have tantrums because he really hated being a dishwasher. But people were like, oh, I know, if only we had a better job for him. But he can go home and paint. And that's what he does. And they protected him and his family because it was all one family. And here, families are encouraged, take your disabled people, send them to this school, send them to that school. And it's a very different culture with regard to the connectedness of the family. And it wasn't quite so bad. When I was a child, we had extended family events all the time. But now I'm an older person in a family where there's really no extended family. And it's that culture is totally lost. The Chinese people, though, they were treated so badly. And that's why, in a way, they were able to regroup. And nobody even noticed. Nobody in the West noticed that China was doing really well. If they had, they probably would have attacked them again. So it's fortunate.
I think there was an element of racism in the whole thing, because when the United States opened up to China and accepted it as a trading partner, the United States expected them to be the junior partners in the worldwide class war against the working class. And they didn't think that the little yellow dwarves would be smart enough to work in their own interests and take the technology and make it their own and use it to their advantage and to the advantage of their society. And I think the United States was lulled to sleep by that racism.
Well, and the United States and Great Britain in particular really are part of the reason you were trying to say little yellow dwarves. Like right now, especially people in northern China are tall. And the people at the restaurant, the parents were small, but their children were tall because the parents starved when they were children.
By the way, just to be clear, I put little yellow dwarves in quotes. I don't think of them
right,
that way.
Right, right. This is what people in the United States, this was the image presented to us. But the reality is that the real Chinese culture is a very healthy culture, a culture that eats healthy food, a culture of people who practice all kinds of different martial arts and health-related exercises, a culture of people who take very good care of themselves and their family, but they starve. They starve for 100 years. That's why they call it the century of humiliation. And the West, the United States and Great Britain in particular, enforced that with gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah, and it was the revolution of 1949 that, as Chairman Mao said, allowed China to stand up. And it's what has brought China to where it is today. Are they the number one, the largest economy in the world, or are they still second to the United States, depending on how you measure it?
I think they're the largest now.
Maybe all the people who go around saying that socialism has never worked ought to think again.
Well, the problem is, and this is something that's much debated on the left, and it makes it easy for lefties who are racist to come forward, and also for some of the Chinese immigrants. During the Cultural Revolution, the elite or the middle class fragmented in China between those who wanted to support the revolutionary initiative, which was not going well at that time, and those who wanted to preserve the middle class, the upper middle class, the bourgeois class. So the ones that weren't happy came here. And they're still here, and they're still pretty right-wing. The thing about China is people will tell you, well, it's not really socialist because they have all these enterprises there that make money, and that's capitalism. But you have to differentiate between the place of capitalism in their society and the place of capitalism in our society. Because in our society, a few capitalist robber barons run everything. Whereas in their society, they have a government that restrains the capitalist powers and keeps them under wraps.
It forces them to act in society's best interest instead of always just in pursuit of their own private profit.
And they've done some things. I see there's videos, you can watch videos on YouTube that are hostile to the Chinese government and will say, oh, they're going to fall any minute and so on. But if people in the high levels of the hierarchy do things to encourage for capitalism to go ahead of the people or do things that are ripping off the government, then they are heartily and heavily punished. Whereas here, white-collar crime is generally kind of a joke.
You rarely hear of an executive going to prison.
Yes, in China, they go to prison for a long time, and you could be executed depending on what you did. And they have, like, these young people. They have a lot of beautiful young people. They have a wonderful entertainment industry there right now. But some of the stars, if they stop paying their taxes, they have to pay, people in that income bracket have to pay, like, 70% taxes, income taxes. And why not? They're still rich, even after they do that. But they support the engine that keeps the country alive and the rest of the people. So at any rate, though, I know there are a couple of stars that completely lost their career because they were stashing money in the West, in Western banks, and not paying their taxes. And there are generals who were, again, they lost everything. They lost their position in society and lost their money because they were corrupt and they were threatening to undermine the government. So the Chinese government has an element of instability, but that element of instability has thus far kept it on course. Whereas here, every time a little bit of instability comes into the government, the capitalists take more power because money is power here.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Judy Bello on China. Judy Bello has been an anti-war activist since she started protesting the Vietnam War in 1969. Today, Judy is editor and administrator of a number of anti-war websites, including the United National Anti-War Coalition, No to War, Ban Killer Drones, and Sanctions Kill. She spent a month in China in the summer of 2025, which is the subject of this interview. Oh, I want to go back to something else from my youth. We're talking about the 1960s. I remember I would always read in the newspapers about how there were massive floods in China and millions of people were washed away and drowned. You don't really hear those kind of stories anymore, do you?
No. And at that time, too, I remember the stories of the starving children in China. And one of my friends who I met at the Chinese restaurant in the 70s was a cook who was here on a green card that had been bought for him, basically, by the restaurant. And he said that his family starved and that they basically walked across the south of China and made it to Hong Kong, where the West still had money. He had a wife and children in China. Like every time he went back, he spent some time in China, had another kid, and then left and stayed here for another 10 years making money to support them. But this was happening because no one had been taking care of the environment there for a very long time. And no one had been addressing the poverty for a long time. And the newly formed government there did not have the resources initially to do anything about it. And that's why the Great Green Wall, for instance, is so important. And the poverty alleviation program is so important.
The reason we used to hear all those stories about the flooding and the starving children in China or starving people in China was that the social system didn't care about the common people. It wasn't that those were natural disasters. They weren't. They were failures of the social system, failures of capitalism or feudalism, because there was no private profit to be made from remedying those conditions. And it was only with the advent of the Chinese Communist Party that somebody actually cared about the common people and invested the resources into fixing those problems.
Yes, and you can really see that because literally the British were paying farmers to grow opium and they couldn't make any money growing food. And when the Communist Party came to power, they got rid of opium addiction in a very short period of time, which seems harsh to us, but they executed big-time drug dealers, but they paid the farmers to grow food. And they provided drug treatment programs for everyone and jobs for anyone who went to one of those programs. And it became too dangerous to have the drugs, but you could have a job and food, which was not available before. And so they very quickly got rid of the opium growing in China and the addiction problem, which actually you can see that, say, in India, that didn't happen, or even in Iran. Iran, I think, not that people are all addicts there, but that opium is still, like, Muslims can't drink alcohol, but they can smoke.
I remember hearing a story from, I forget which country, but it was from an African country, and there was a famine there. In the meantime, the agriculture had been all colonized. It had been taken over by big corporations, and they were growing cotton to export to foreign countries while their people starved. And there was one commentator who said, well, if people were starving, it was not for lack of cotton.
Yeah, well, and in China, they do. Even now, they grow a lot of cotton. That was one of the crops I saw most of.
But that's okay because the people are fed.
That's right. That's right. And one interesting thing I saw in Guizhou was on the mountainsides. As you go up to the mountain, you see these little areas of land where people are growing things. Not a full field, because you couldn't put a field, full field on the mountainside. And they were literally growing corn and squash. And so you could see the line of squash along the road, and behind it, maybe like 20 or 50 corn plants. And so everywhere you go, they use every bit of land to have crops and to have and to better their lifestyle. Nothing is wasted. And the government has programs to help anybody that wants to move forward and have more assistance with growing things, with building roads or housing or any of those things. All that is really supported by the government. I want to say one more word, too, about the Uyghurs, because the propaganda, there's just been so much awful propaganda about how the Chinese government persecuted them for being Muslim and so on. And there's a number of aspects of this story, and poverty alleviation is covered over some of them. But in that region that borders on Pakistan and Afghanistan, where the U.S. deliberately created Al-Qaeda, there was a branch of what you might call Al-Qaeda, and that group was killing people in that area. They were very, very dangerous, and they were sort of nurtured in these Saudi mosques, the same as they were in Afghanistan and the same as they were actually in parts of Syria. So the government, they didn't start a war, they didn't kill them all, but they put them in, the young people, in retraining schools so that they would learn to make a living. And I've met people who actually went to one of those schools and came out and got a good job, and they're happy raising their family. But they were a menace to the people who actually lived there. They were not, it wasn't persecution of Muslims. It was dealing with a group of people who are a menace to their own society. Like, say, to say that, say, controlling the mafia is racist against all Italian people. Not really. Italian people want to live well. They don't want to be governed by, you know, warlords. And the same is true of the Muslims in Western China. So what's happening there now is pretty healthy. It has its positive and negative aspects because it transitions, like poverty alleviation does have some stress. But the people there are doing well. And when I was in Hotan, which is the heart of Uyghur country, they have a huge park in the center of the city, and all these people come out there and dance every night. At any rate, people find ways, and this is a way without spending a lot of money to be social and to have a good time and to celebrate your culture, because some of the people are doing dances that are similar to Tai Chi, and others are doing dances that are Uyghur traditional dances, and there's just all kinds of stuff going on. There are little children running around.
But this all sounds quite different from what we hear in the Western corporate CIA media, which is that there's a genocide. And it begs the question of, where is the documentary evidence of that genocide? Where's the video? Where are the pictures of piles of dead bodies? I haven't seen anything like that.
No, and I haven't either, and I don't think you will. And not only that, but even in Shanghai, I saw women wearing hijabs on the subway and so on. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time there either. It wasn't like I had to, like, work at finding them. They were just walking down the street with everybody else or on the subway or whatever. China has a very diverse society. And another point to be made about Islam is that the Communist Party in China and Russia and everywhere else isn't real excited about religion. Like, supporting religion isn't on their agenda. However, persecuting it, and especially now after all the opening up, is also not on their agenda. So at one point, like back during the days of the Cultural Revolution, the communist government was not friendly to religious organizations. But that was a long time ago. And since then, everything has opened up, and the Buddhist temples are open, the Muslim mosques are open, everything, you know, Christian churches.
So they neither encourage or discourage it.
Right. At one point, I think they did discourage it, because at the beginning of the revolution, they were Marxists, and they were humanists. That's part of communism, is to be humanist rather than religious. But that has changed to the extent that, you know, all the religions, if you go to Tibet, the Buddhists are still there. They just don't run the area anymore, but they're still there. And now they have a democratic government instead of a feudal government. And that's true everywhere. And in Xinjiang is really part of the fabric of China and has been for very, very, you know, thousands of years. It's just that it's much more open to outside influences on the western border, where they are connected to West Asia, than on the eastern border, where basically they're connected to the ocean. And the culture is influenced more by outside forces on the western border.
Let's talk about one more subject and then wrap it up, and that would be Taiwan. Do you feel that the Chinese government is being aggressive on that issue? And how do the common people feel about Taiwan?
Well, everyone in China feels that Taiwan is part of China. And the Chinese government has not been aggressive towards Taiwan. However, the United States is baiting them into a certain level of aggression around Taiwan, not directed towards Taiwan, but say in the sea around Taiwan. The United States has imported a whole bunch of Western weapons into Taiwan recently. And the history is that Taiwan was a province of China until the Japanese occupied it around 1900, somewhere around there, give or take a few years. And they held it until the end of World War II, at which point it was given back to China. However, at the success of the Chinese Revolution, the Republican government fled to Taiwan, and the United States used it as a launching pad for the Korean War. All of the resources that were used to support the Korean War were located on Taiwan, and the Kuomintang supported that. Since then, actually, the Kuomintang, which believes that there's only one China, has supported reunion with China, but there are new parties supported by the United States with a lot of money and a lot of weapons and a lot of publicity that are pushing for independence from China. And they take the stance that they were never part of China, which is ridiculous if you know any history, because, as I say, Taiwan was a part of China until it was occupied by the Japanese. And right now, this is becoming more and more sensitive, because now the latest Japanese prime minister has said that they want to arm themselves to protect Taiwan. And that's just ridiculous. The Japanese invaded China and took over large areas of China on the East Coast and perpetrated horrific violence against the Chinese people for decades. So when the Japanese prime minister says, we want to get armed to go against China for part of their property, the Chinese are like really upset.
That should set off some alarm bells, I would think.
Yeah. And it's a big problem right now. And something I just learned from a book I was reading, I got a comic book in China to practice my Chinese. But something I hadn't been aware of was that at the end of World War I, the peace conference in Paris gave a province of China to Japan, even though both China and Japan had fought on the same side as the U.S. in World War I, they gave a province of China to Japan. And that is what triggered the Republican and the Communist revolutions at that time. So China is very sensitive about Japanese aggression. And I think we need to understand that. Taiwan is closer to China than Cuba is to Florida. It's a part of China, clearly, from a geological standpoint. If you look at an aerial map, you can see the elevated seabed around Taiwan that attaches it to the mainland.
But yet the United States insists on what they call freedom of navigation, which is really an aggressive intrusion into Chinese waters. It will sail its warships through the strait, and China sees that as an invasion.
Well, I think we would see it as an invasion if China insisted on circumnavigating the
Gulf of Mexico
south of the United States. I think they'd find it pretty disturbing if we had Chinese ships trolling up and down the eastern seaboard within 50 miles of the United States land. This is no joke to the Chinese at all. And the fact that they haven't responded in a violent way at all, but they have built up their military, and who can blame them? They don't know. Are they going to be attacked?
The United States has armed Taiwan to the teeth.
Yes, it has. And it's rearming Japan now. And for the Chinese, this is like terrifying. And again, Japan, if you look at Japan and Korea, they're just a few miles from China. It's a horrific invasion of their space. This is not legal. You do not put missiles on somebody's border.
My understanding is that the United States runs what they call war games or practice invasions in the South Korean Peninsula a few times a week, at least.
They actually do landfall in North Korea.
The North Koreans never know if it's for real this time.
Right, because they go right up on the beach. But North Korea doesn't want to start a war. That's why they built the nuclear bomb, because they don't want to start a war, but they want to have some level of defense.
Well, that might be a good place to wrap it up.
Yes, I'm fine with that. I just want to say I'm grateful to have this chance to talk about my trip to China and also about really the impressive, the amazing work that they've done there in restoring a country that had more or less fallen into ruin under other leadership and under really, it had fallen into a feudal disaster when the Chinese Revolution brought it back together and provided really a leading voice, not only for prosperity in the world, but for technology and science and the development of places in Africa and Latin America that have been living under oppressive circumstances since European colonialism began a few hundred years ago. And they're really making a real difference in the world. And the things they're doing, like you could say, well, they're preserving their own desert. Well, guess what? They're sharing that technology with people in the north of Africa and the Sahel, who also have a huge desert that's pressing down on them. And this is really important work they're doing for the whole planet.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was Judy Bellow on China. Judy Bellow has been an anti-war activist since she started protesting the Vietnam War in 1969. Today, Judy is editor and administrator of a number of anti-war websites, including the United National Anti-War Coalition, No to War, Ban Killer Drones, and Sanctions Kill. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.